Hello and welcome to the Dense City Podcast, a show where we meet with academics to discuss their research on cities. I'm your co-host, Isaac Keast. Today we meet with Heike Markart and Juliana Schicketanz. Heike is a research associate at the Institute of Transport Research at the German Aerospace Center in Berlin. Her research focuses include urban geography and mobility, particularly mobility related to health, well-being, and environmental stressors, using qualitative methods and wearable sensors. Juliana is a PhD student at the Humboldt University of Berlin. Her research interests include urban geography and its intersection with human health, as well as the sense of place of children. We'll be discussing their article, Experiences of Safe and Healthy Walking and Cycling in Urban Areas, The Benefits of Mobile Methods for Citizen-Adapted Urban Planning, published in Transportation Research Procedia in 2022. The article is premised on the idea that despite the benefits of active transportation like walking and cycling, users of these modes continuously feel like neglected road users. Among the most dependent on active transportation are younger children. Youth can be independent travelers of their neighborhoods years before they can obtain a driver's license, making active transportation an innate part of urban life for them. Today's article uses in-situ mobile interviews to explore the lived experiences of adults and youth on their active commutes. Let's get into the paper and see what this can tell us about designing for walkable and bikeable cities. So, would you be able to walk us through the purpose of the article?
Yeah, of course. Well, maybe a short explanation beforehand in this article. We have two studies. So there's the one study from Juliana Schicketanz, who was working with children and explaining the insights from the mobile methods, and my study, which was on the cyclists' commute in Berlin. And we conducted the same method in both studies, and we discussed the method of mobile interviews, so go or ride along interviews in both of the regarding both of the studies, and showed the benefits and the possibilities of these methods for both adult cyclists and children.
Okay, so the specific purpose of the paper was to examine mobile methods using active transportation.
Yes, because we figured out that there are quite a few studies out there measuring quantitatively the impacts, for example, of the built environment on commuting or active travel to school, but they are missing more detailed or in-depth information on how people perceive their environment, because it's an individual decision how they go to work or to school, and or if they go by car or if they walk. And it really depends on how they perceive their environments. And for example, whether they decide to take detours or not is really individual. So that's why we decided for this go or ride along method. And then we came together because with our two topics, we figured out the method is really similar, even though Heike did it with adults, and I did my interviews with children. And it's something which is kind of overseen in urban planning. It's not a common method to prepare urban planning processes.
Yeah, and to add to that, I just wanted to add one point about it. For us, the focus was really on the being on the move. So we really wanted to take a look at how do people perceive their environment while moving, and not having a post-hoc interview or having a survey after they did a certain route or something, but really take into account this movement and experience how the perceived environment changes while being on the move. And this was really the focus of our studies.
In my case, I first did a quantitative analysis of routes to school in the city of Leipzig. I did this typical regression analysis steps, and I figured out that very commonly known factors impacted the active school travel. For example, the population density. So how close children live to the city center, the denser is the city, and yeah. The shorter are the routes to school. So, of course, those children close to the city center in a densely populated area were walking or cycling to school. And the ones living in the suburban area, not very densely populated, decided to go by car, or the parents decided. And I have to say, we are talking about primary school children. So between in Germany, between 6 and 10 years old, approximately. But there were, I analyzed, let's say about 45 factors. And I figured out that there were a lot more factors which were not significantly important for my analysis. But for example, the number of siblings was really, I could look at the group of children with no siblings, with one sibling, or with two and more siblings. And I saw the one with one sibling were more actively on their routes to school and the other ones not. And in my, yeah, and that was, for example, one point where I like stopped and thought, okay, there might be something behind, which I won't find in my numbers. And yeah, I can say from my qualitative study that it really depends on the age of the siblings and also the place where the other siblings are going to in the mornings, for example. So to the kindergarten, which is close to the primary school, or to a high school, which is quite far away. And then there's no dependency between both routes and the mode of transport. So that was, yeah, my first step of analysis where I decided I should go into depth.
Well, that's what made me interested in your paper in the first place, because that's kind of where I mean, I'm not a researcher by any means, but I've always thought that asking people how they feel about their commutes in person, I've always gained such a bigger understanding than when I look at facts and numbers, as powerful as they may be. People have opinions and you can't just force people to walk if it's not an environment that's conducive to it. So moving along, can you walk us through some of the literature that you use to inform your paper?
Well, we have looked a lot into the research which was conducted using also mobile methods. So we took a look at what other studies exist which made use of walking interviews, or also called go and ride alongs. And there are quite a lot of studies which made use of these methods, for example, for researching how people perceive their health facilities in their area. So they walk through the space and talk about different health possibilities. Or there are other studies which made use of ride alongs, for example, and really going deep. Diving deep into the kinesthetic and feeling of cycling. So really go how it is for a person to cycle.
By that, do you mean like cycling infrastructure and...
Yeah, and the feeling of cycling. So the embodied experience of cycling was, for example, investigated with these ride-along interviews.
Right. Had there been significant ride-along interviews at that point?
Not so many. So I know this one from Spinney, for example, who did it. And I don't know so many others, I actually have to say. I think mostly these mobile methods are used with walking. So people are walking together through the street, discussing how they perceive their environment. But there are not many ride-along interviews. There are some, but not many. And I think with children, it's even less, actually.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other reason I was really interested in your study. But I was going to say cycling ride-alongs almost seem dangerous.
You know, maybe we can talk about this when we talk about the methods section. I think it depends a bit on the infrastructure where you're or the city you live in. And in Berlin, it was quite doable. Mm. But of course, safety is an important issue and it has to be really discussed beforehand how to do this interview. And both people have to have their recording device on their collar so you don't have to ride next to each other all the time. So there are a lot of things you have to consider when doing ride-alongs, definitely.
Right. Yeah, you need the infrastructure for it. I'm just thinking, I mean, I'm from Canada and I've lived in Toronto and Vancouver, and even the best cycling infrastructure here is like a 2 meter wide lane. So even at the best of times, you're pretty tight together. Yeah, I guess, I mean, in certain cities where you have a whole road to yourself, it might be different. So,
yeah. And in my case, there are also, like Heike said, there are like a handful of studies with walking interviews and children. Like about 10 or 15 years ago, there were some more out there. For example, an interview from UK from 2009. Where they did something which, or they used a smartphone-based interview method to really let the children, which were older than in my case, like say youth children, to map their own routes to school with a app-based interview. So they asked them to take photographs and to like put some notes in their app. And then afterwards, they did the sedentary interviews. And also another study did applied the photo voice method, which is quite common. So they asked the children to just take photographs and did interviews afterwards. Yeah, but what you don't get with this method is the way how they behave along their routes. So sometimes children just stop or do something what they do every day on their routes to school because, yeah, they cover the route every day. But you don't see like those views or pauses or whatever. So yeah, that's why we went for the go-alongs. And I also did ride-alongs, but not with the cycling, but with car or public transport.
Okay.
So I had 14 interviews, and three of them were covered by car and one by public transport, because I really asked the children, how do they cover their routes usually? And I will just accompany them however they go or walk. In my case, yeah, I also had to consider certain things. So I always asked the parents to walk or go with their children, even though I had quite a big group of children, like approximately the half of the interviews where children usually walked without parents, or in a group of children, but without a parent. But for data security issues, I had to ask the parents to walk with us.
Of course, yeah. One of the things I was looking for specifically when I was looking at papers is children depend on active transportation so much more than everyone else, right? They don't really have the option. And so I've always kind of thought, and this is not something I came up with, all cities would be safer if they were designed for children to be able to use uninhibited as they please. But children are harder to study because of some of those barriers that you mentioned. But anyways, yeah, all of that was why I was really interested in this. And I actually in school remember doing photo voice. And that is a really interesting way to gain information on a street or on someone's experience. And you do get to see their facial expressions and ask them about why they made decisions that they wouldn't, you know, maybe even consider conscious.
Yeah, the point is why it's difficult to include children in planning or even research is that they sometimes have a huge imagination.
Mm.
So sometimes they tell you stories or wishes. Yeah, what they would wish for their route to school. And they think, okay, that will never happen.
a slide.
Yeah, and so their perspective is quite special, let's say. But you can always make something out of it. For example, if someone wishes for a lake along the route to school, then maybe the like elements of water or whatever could already help.
Mm.
Like if they think of the hot summer days or, yeah, what children really expressed quite often in my interviews is that they need something which is interesting. And for parents or adults, it's hard to understand what does it mean. Sometimes it can be something really, really small, and we will come to the results later. But yeah, you have to have it in mind that children sometimes really see some things different. So parents would say, okay, that's a dirty area, I would not pass this area, there's a lot of rubbish and whatever. But children connected with a individual story or what they experienced together with another child there, so the view can be very different from the adult perspective. And I think that is something what makes it right now for planners difficult to include children's views, but there are ways how to do that. And it's not only about children's are vulnerable group and they need more safety, and they have a very low body height. That's something which is more and more included in planning, but the special, I would say, sense of place or their special perspective on their environments is something which is completely overseen.
Mm.
It's more in urban planning has a tendency like to build a fence around the children and to like build up a new playground or whatever, but not to include them in the traffic safety in the daily routes. And what is really important to say is that the travel behavior, how would children learn how to move from A to B, is something which will impact their entire life. So children who are really used to urban traffic jams or whatever, or who are used to cycle with their mom or dad, they will kind of remember the travel behavior in their later life. It's not something completely surreal to walk from A to B. But if they learn that's a normal way how to travel to a certain place or how to cover 1 kilometer, then they will do it in their later life. There are studies out there showing that it's really important to address the children.
Absolutely. I mean, I grew up driving everywhere, and if I just didn't hate it so much, I still would probably, because most people do. Most people, I mean, who grow up in suburbia, they kind of do adopt that default car mode. But yeah, that is why planning for children matters, because we will talk about this more when we get into the results. But I actually laughed out loud when I was reading the research and you talked about how children would point out things like puddles. And I wrote down that that's like a point of interest. Because for a child, yes, that's a point of interest. That's like a landmark, right? And you said the term a sense of place. And those things, they're like landmarks that you remember when you pass them. We saw that puddle. It helps you build a mental map of your environment, and that's valuable.
It's also interesting that children are actually walking and cycling quite a lot when they're children, right? So, and then they're growing up and that they're walking and cycling less and less. So walking and cycling is actually something common for children for their daily leisure routes or their everyday activities, right? And while they grow up, it gets less and less and they tend to use the car more. So it's also, I think, important to keep that activity of walking and cycling and make it still feasible and fun and interesting and safe when they grow up as well.
Yeah. And of course, parents are in the end the decision makers of this travel decision process. But in my case, in my interviews, children also have wishes. Like they really feel proud when they are allowed to walk without a parent. Or they really ask the parents, let's walk in this morning because I can meet a friend along the route. So of course, they are not the decision makers, but they can drive the process in their direction, and we have to listen to them.
Mm-hmm. And if it's interesting, they'll want to.
Yes.
Now, I guess we've talked about the methodology, but can you explain to us in detail what these methods look like? Heike, you talked about it a little bit when you said the cycling ride-along ones, you know, you strap on the microphone and everything. Can you elaborate a bit about that and how that looks?
Yeah, of course. As for the cyclists ride-alongs, I had an introductory interview at the beginning, which I think is really important for these ride-alongs in order to make the situation or explain the situation to the interviewee so they know what's going to happen. So having a little introductory interview where we already talked about the route that we will take together. So me as an interviewer was already prepared of what might happen and where we will go through or go when we ride through the city. And then I had a semi-structured interview guideline I was having attached to my bike and having in my mind quite well, with also some ad hoc questions, but also questions I were preparing beforehand based on literature. And the interviewee and me, we were both having, as I already said, this recording device attached to our collar so we could both talk freely. Also, when we were, for example, not riding next to one another because of a narrow bike lane or something, the person could still go on talking after I have questioned him or her something. So that was important for safety reasons, I think. And while cycling together, we sometimes made a pause and talked about the environmental situation we were, but also while cycling, we talked about different aspects. And for example, for me, it was really important to dive deep into the sensorial experiences. So I talked about, or I asked them, what do you hear? What do you smell? What do you see? How does it impact your well-being? How does it impact your health? Which was really interesting because my interviewees could, while cycling, elaborate about their environment and try to really experience what do I actually hear? What do I see? What do I smell at the moment? And therefore, we could go right into these aspects also of air pollution, of noise, but also about positive sounds, for example, birds chirping or seeing greenery or smelling water. So all these aspects could really be revealed by having this qualitative ride-along interview together. And meanwhile, I also took photos with my camera. So I had a camera as well attached on my bicycle, so I could also include the photo or the environmental situation with a photo while cycling together. And I also, but I didn't put it in this paper, but I also measured air pollution and noise while we cycled together, which is not, the results are not part of this paper, but this was also something I included as well with this method. So I think it's an important or a good method where you can also include other aspects into the ride along. So you don't have to only use the qualitative data, but you can use, for example, wearable sensors on air pollution and noise or make photos while cycling. So you can also use other data or gather also other data while moving together and combine these data with this qualitative interview data you gathered on site or while moving.
But that was a separate research?
No, that's the same research basically, but in this paper, we only discussed the method of mobile interviews together, and we discussed how is it usable for urban planning and this combination of qualitative mobile interview data and wearable sensor data is part of another research, but with the same participants.
It sounded like you were acting like a psychiatrist on these interviews because you're really asking people, how do you feel about it? And a lot of people never think about it, but people do actually have opinions on these things when they think about them.
And I think this is something that is really a really good or a really benefit of this method, because I a lot of times had the feeling that my interviewees were starting to think about things they've never thought about, but they actually do impact them while cycling. And asking them about that made them think and overthink about it and try to realize, yeah, that does actually impact my perceived health. I've never thought about that, which also led to the question, do I actually want to be made aware of that? So when we talked about air pollution, for example, or noise pollution, while cycling together, they were like, yeah, no, actually, I smell, like, I asked, what do you smell? And they're like, oh, I smell pollution. Oh, I smell this pollution. It's really bad. I've never thought about this. Does it impact my health? And then they started to become aware, and not in a positive way a lot of times. So sometimes it's maybe not the best way to be made aware. That was something we also discussed while cycling together. And I think these mobile interviews do have a great opportunity to also dive into these aspects, which may not be in the mind of the interviewees so easily. So you really have to go into depth to investigate them there.
Air pollution, noise pollution, I mean, you can't even really see it so much. Yeah, no, I would rather, that's a good point. I would rather not know. Julianne, how about while studying the commutes to school? How did those interviews go?
Yeah, I first started to contact primary schools because I wanted to do my interviews in three different neighborhoods. Like based on my study beforehand, one was in a suburban area, not very densely populated. So the children had longer routes to school. In another area, which was also suburban, it was more dense populated with a lower socioeconomic status. And the other study area was done close to the city center of Leipzig. I have to say that primary school children, public primary school children, officially should have a walkable route to school in Germany, at least in the urban areas.
Is there a law for that?
There's kind of a law which separate areas in the city, or like it depends on the place where you are living, to which public primary school you are allowed to walk, allowed to go.
I see.
So there are school service areas just for public primary schools. And most of the German children are going to a public primary school. So in my first study, there were like 10% participating in a private primary school. And most of the children are going to a public primary school. So I decided to go for the public primary school because there is kind of a planning process behind, which you could adapt. So building one primary school to each other does not make sense when you think of the active school travel. So there's the city area should be covered nicely by different primary schools. So yeah, I first contacted schools and they contacted one class, one group of children. And then I got in contact with the parents and we had a phone call where I presented the method. And then they told me whether I should accompany them on the way to school or from school. And then we had an introductory part standing in front of the school or in front of their homes, like the first 10 minutes. And then we started walking. As I had no cycling interviews, it was easy to stop somewhere else and ask them to calculate some more minutes for the interviews than they do usually. And half of my participants decided to be accompanied in the morning and the other half in the afternoon, really depending on their usual, for example, group composition, because in the mornings there were quite a few walking groups which I accompanied. So children which met at one place and then walked together to school. And in my case, I always first introduced the method to the children to make them, like to put them in the center of the interview. And I really asked the children to take photographs with a smartphone. So they were geocoded and I could include them in my analysis. And then they also had a microphone. With the walking groups, it was quite difficult because I only had two devices. But in the end, I mostly could translate it into text. And then we walked together and I had also a semi-guided interview structure. But I also took the photographs as a starting point to talk about certain places. And then I always first ask the children and then ask the parents.
Right. So just kind of conversational.
Yeah. And I really ask the children to walk the route to school, how they do it every day. So I had some surprising situations that children decided, like, because the parents were always there, even though they usually didn't accompany the children, then the children walked one way and the parents said, but I told you to go the other way. And then we walked the way the children decided.
Mm.
And surprisingly, in this composition where the parents usually stayed at home, they were not like, they just mentioned, okay, I taught you to use this route. They really accepted the way how the children covers his route.
Huh.
So they were quite relaxed because they already stepped behind and they already had the decision in the past that the children is able to do it on its own and however the children prefers.
I think this is also the strength of this method as well, that we as the interviewer are also observers. So we're on the one hand interviewers and are interviewing the interviewees while walking or cycling, but at the same time, we're also observers and observing the situation. So this is also kind of the data we're gathering. For example, what I saw or what happened or what I saw that my interviewees did while cycling together, or what you just said, Juliana, is also part of the data we gathered, right? So we have like both views. We as the observers, then the interview answers of the interviewees, the photographs, and so we have how a person perceives and acts in their environment from different points of views, which is, I think, a really nice benefit of this method as well.
And especially in the case of children, it's really a good method, at least to lower the distance between the researcher and the children. Because, of course, I'm also an adult. And for the children, I'm kind of at the same level like their parents. But like to make them to be the experts and like already to give them the smartphone to take photographs, they feel like kind of empowered and kind of more active in the interview situation. But in my case, the children who were still walking together with their parents were less active during the interviews than the children who already felt to be the experts of their routes to school because they are used to walk without adults.
Right. Now let's talk about some of the results from the paper. So you break it down into safety, perceptions and experiences, and statements en route. Can you walk us through these?
Yeah, maybe we can start with the results which we found in both our studies and which were quite similar. And I think one of the most interesting results, both from Juliana and me, was the high importance of interesting sites. We already said it at the beginning with the puddles. So for the cyclists, while we were cycling together, they pointed out a lot of times interesting sites and highlights. So landmarks along their routes, or a specific tree they liked while passing it, or an interesting abandoned house which made them curious while cycling, improved their route. And I was looking into commuting routes. So I was looking onto these everyday routes people cycle from work to home or back, which can be quite dull, I think, for a lot of people. But while cycling together and having this mobile method and this qualitative interviews while moving, my interviewees talked a lot about, these little interesting highlights along their route, which made their trip actually really pleasant for them. Even though, for example, we had sometimes high pollution and quite busy road, but looking at this specific house, which has this interesting facade, is something really important for them on their route. And they really like cycling past this house, or going past one of the big landmarks of Berlin made them always feel attached to their city, because this is something, everyone knows the Berliner Fernsehturm, which is basically one of the landmarks of Berlin, and cycling past it made them feel attached. So all these little highlights along the routes, which were really made the route pleasant for them, even though it's basically their route to work, which is kind of an inevitable route they have to do. And I think this is quite similar to what Juliana also found out, because these highlights were also really important for the children, I guess.
Yeah, as we already talked about the puddles, in my case, mostly the frozen puddles. I conducted my interviews in spring and summer, so they were not frozen during the interview situation. And maybe they were just frozen once or twice in the winter time, but it's something children really remember. And so that makes places special, which for adults are quite boring. There were quite a few. So some bushes where they could hide behind were really important. So this hiding activity is really important for children to build kind of a distance between adults and them, to have their own spaces. There are quite a few studies showing, for example, that for schoolyards, it's also important to have such places.
The whole idea of mobility goes towards their sort of independence, you know?
Yeah.
And that, I think, ties into that separation from adults.
Yeah.
Their ability to go about the city on their own.
Yes, yes. And they also sometimes showed me kind of shortcuts, which were not shortcuts at all, which were more like detours. But yeah, as you said, it's their independent route choice, which is important for them, but also places like bakeries, supermarkets, places which they mentioned, or places where friends of them were living. So they really connect stories, mostly from the past, which with places and also experiences in groups. So that is something which I really want to highlight with my study, that building walking groups really may help to support children's active travel, because they, in this group composition, let's say two children together or seven children together, they really experience the way as something like meeting a friend, and it's not covering the route from A to B. So being together is more important. And they also use the time to reflect on their school day or to have exclusive time together with a parent. Which also led to some results of Heike. In my case, the natural environment, which is always highlighted in urban planning, so we need more green areas, were not that important in my study. So parks are sometimes even frightening children, because they are not that crowded, for example, in the mornings. But some elements of the natural environment were places where they stopped or where they played, for example, a small stream or a tree where they could climb on. So it was mentioned, and when it was mentioned, it was more positively mentioned, but it was not one of the most important places during the interviews.
Maybe to add to also the point that you said before about the social aspects of walking together for children, which was important for their route. My cyclists that I interviewed, one important aspect was for them also the social aspect of their city. For example, when they were cycling through greenery, they talked about how it relaxes them to see other people sitting around, flying a kite or playing football or skating. And they talked a lot about the importance of passing spaces in their city where people do have a relaxed time, where people hang around, where people feel good. And they said that this makes them feel good as well. And that for them, it was really important to include these spaces in their route where they see other people, see how other people have a good time. And I think, I mean, it's a bit different than what you said, Juliana, with a group of children walking together. But I think it kind of relates to the same aspect of the importance of social aspects while walking or cycling. So for the mobility, it's really important to have also these social places, even with the group or in the city. And regarding greenery, I think it was the same for cyclists, as you also said. For them, it was a bit more important, I think, as for your children, the importance of greenery and water. But I also think this is the case because they cycled a longer route. So it was more easily for them to include greenery and water along their route. And as for the cyclists, I found it really interesting that for them, even a small glimpse of water, just passing the river of Berlin, which is called Spree, just passing the river was in one of the highlights of their route. And they just had one glimpse of the water while cycling past it and then go back into a highly trafficked road and in the inner city areas. But only this little part of seeing this river was really important for that trip. So yeah, I think it's a bit different from the children because we had longer routes, but I really like this aspect of, yeah, only small glimpses of water and greenery can already improve the cyclist's route.
And you have to add the animals.
Animals?
And the animals. Yeah, for the cyclists, it was really like a lot of times, or not a lot of times, but sometimes my cyclists talked about the importance of animals. So while we were passing, for example, some greenery or more parks, they talked about that they usually see the foxes there because in Berlin are quite some foxes which are living in the city.
Oh, wow.
And you can see them in the evenings. And I had two people who were talking about, I usually see a fox here in the evening. And I really am looking forward to this part of the route because I may see with the fox again. Or other people talked about the rabbits which are living in the little green spaces in the city, and they like seeing them, or they like hearing the birds chirping in the parks. Or one person even said he found it interesting that he sometimes sees a boar in the evening. It's a bit outside the city, but still there can be boars. So I think the importance of seeing animals was also happening quite a lot. Or they talked a lot about the importance of seeing animals, my interviewees, and I liked it a lot. I don't know if how it happened with you, Juliana, as well with the children.
In my case, they were more negatively mentioned, let's say like barking dogs or like frightening dogs around the route. And yeah, that was mostly it. In one case, it was a cat living around and then they stopped by, but not that it was not that much important, but I can't explain why. Because I imagine that if they would have a fox along the route to school, they would have taught me.
The one thing that I've immediately learned from this conversation is that there's a lot of unexpected information that you gain from this. Information that you really wouldn't pick up one anywhere else, and information that no one would even really think to ask. Like, honestly, Heike, when you were talking about the experiences of cycling in Berlin, I felt almost like it was my experience in Toronto, because, you know, Toronto has the famous CN Tower. If I got a glimpse of that on my cycle to work, made my day. If I cycled across Yonge Street and I could look right down Yonge Street and you see right to the lake, that little glimpse of water did improve my cycle, and I would smile when I saw that. An interesting facade on a home. There was this one house that we used to call the Greek house because it was done up in plaster and it was all bright blue and you couldn't drive your car straight down the street, but it was a cycling route. So we always got to see that. And those things make your day. And it's just, I really felt like you had interviewed me almost when you were talking about that. It's so similar to my commute.
And it's interesting if you would have said the same points if I would have asked you post-talk, like having an interview with you and ask you what are the most important aspects of your route. You may not think about this landmark or this house facade or this glimpse of water. You may be thinking of other aspects.
Totally.
But I think this is the goal or the benefit of this mobile method, this ride along, to really go with the person on their route and then reveal these aspects which may otherwise be hidden.
Absolutely. If you asked me, I'd probably talk about the bike lanes and stuff. But if you go along with me and we pass that house, I'll be like, oh yeah, I love that house.
Yeah, exactly.
And Juliana, parks being a danger for kids or a perceived almost threat when they weren't occupied. I just want to say Dense City actually did an episode where we talk about some of the dangers of big parks. It definitely makes sense that, you know, kids would perceive that danger as well.
Yeah, children always prefer more crowded routes and their parents as well. So that was a past study which I conducted in Berlin, where there was a park along a route to school, and like parents always told their children to choose a road beside the park. And children also have, they do have a certain sense of feeling safe with certain groups. So having youth at the playground or homeless people around makes them really being frightened, even though they cannot really explain it. So they always try to take a detour if they meet a group of homeless or alcoholics close to a supermarket or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. I had it in the one suburban area where one child was really frightened about a lot of strangers. Yeah, she really had one route to school, and that was the one where she met the less strangers possible and the more peers from the school. Yeah.
That sounds like sort of what you talk about when you talk about the narratives that the kids sort of craft around these stories that they have about their walks to school.
Yeah.
And how those, you talk about in the paper, how those experiences influence how they walk the next time to school. And obviously they're telling you about it, so it stuck with them.
Most of the stories are more positively, so where they experience something positive. But in some cases, I also had those more negatively related experiences, also with some influence of imagination. So that was, in this case, the child had some bad experiences, but then mixed it up with another stories from adults and parents. And yeah, so it's also important for the child because it really impacts how the child walks to school, but it's not measurable in that case.
I think it's the same also, like with a cyclist, the same. If they have experienced an accident in a certain route, they took another route then, or a detour to avoid the street where they had an accident or a near miss accident or something like this. And with this interview or this ride along, we could also ask them, why do we turn to the right here? Because I mean, I have my own mental map of the city in my head, and I know that it might be shorter to take the straight route. And then we turn to the right all of a sudden. I ask them, why do we turn to the right here? And they say, oh yeah, sorry, I didn't thought about this. I had a traffic accident there, and that's why I used now another road. So I think these past experiences can also be revealed as well with this interview, and really shape how routes are chosen afterwards.
Right. everyone's route can sometimes only make sense to themselves because they've crafted their narrative. They've got a history on these streets and they know which ones are dangerous. I have a very intimate experience along these lines where there was a street I didn't go back to for months because there was an accident and it was a pain in the ass to avoid because it was a main street. So you don't forget when it affects your day to day. Anyways, so that was an excellent conversation about the results. Did you have anything else to add to that before we move on to sort of using this research in practice?
Yeah, we already like came into all these negative perspectives, but I wanted to add that, of course, traffic safety was one of the main issues in my interviews, and I think in Heike's interviews as well, that, of course, there were perceived barriers where parents or children decided, okay, that's a barrier which my child is not allowed to cover without a parent or whatever. So, of course, traffic safety and certain traffic situations are important for them and have to be planned better to allow children to walk to school. But looking at the traffic situation, I wanted to add the particular view of children on certain traffic situations, which are kind of different from parents. For example, looking at the traffic light, parents look at different aspects, that the crossing is safe and that there is a traffic light and that there are not cars crossing where the pedestrian has a green light. Children, for example, really feel bothered by if you have two green lights on one street, so you have it you have to cross it step by step. And at first, the second green light gets green, or traffic light gets green, and then the one where you are waiting at. Mm-hmm. So the children feel really bothered by that. And that's unfair. The other ones can cross already and I have to wait. Yeah, that's something which is important. And I have another aspect. For example, if there is some obstacle on a sidewalk and two children were walking in a group, and then they would have to pass this obstacle for 2 meters, one behind the other, and they had to stop talking. Then they felt usually, there should not be this rubbish or whatever, because we really want to talk to each other. And the adult would say, okay, those 2 meters, I don't care. But children do care about certain aspects.
That 2 meters utterly breaks their conversation.
Yeah.
That's cool. Huh. Yeah, and I saw on the topic of safety and the results, I saw that, Heike, you note that cyclists, I even saw that you said that they take the sidewalk on occasion when you were with them. And that's a dire situation. One, because it sucks when you're a cyclist and you have to take the sidewalk. Two, it creates a danger for pedestrians if you're in a place that's any sort of busy.
Yeah, definitely. And it happened not a lot of times, but there were some times when that happened. And the interviewee said that they do it because they don't want to cross the street on a certain part. So they're taking the sidewalk for just a few meters in order to cross the road later where it's easier or less dangerous. Mm-hmm. And also a lot of times there were hidden paths. Juliana had the same with the hidden path with the children. The cyclists, it was the same. There were a lot of hidden paths on their route we took together, which were not always for cyclists. So sometimes it was only pedestrian path through a little greenery or something, and they took it because it's way more pleasant to cycle through the greenery than along the main road for them. And I also think that I had the feeling, and I think it was the same with you, Jana, that the cyclists were also kind of proud about their hidden paths. So they really liked talking about them to me, and they were like, oh, this is my special hidden path to avoid this intersection there, which I do not like at all, but here it's way less stressful. I know it's not allowed to go here, but I do it this, and I really liked the importance of this knowledge of hidden paths. And everyone had this feeling of this is their unique knowledge. Mm-hmm. I really like that. And I think it was the same with you, with the children, Juliana, right?
Yeah. And I was really surprised that adults also behaved like my children.
Mm. Yeah. I love that. When I read that about the shortcuts and secret paths, it made me smile because that is one of my favorite things about interacting with the city. And I totally relate to that pride, because in a city of multiple millions of people, to think that there's a way that only you know is so cool. In a city that everyone's known for thousands of or hundreds of years, there's a way that only you know. And everyone thinks that. And there are to this day routes that I think I only know. And I truly believe that. And it's what makes commuting exciting, you know? It's what makes your city, and it really part of your day-to-day life. Now I'd like to talk about the opportunities for using this research in practice. And that is really, I kind of think, what your paper is sort of all about, because it's talking about how we can use this this research method to really affect transportation planning. I think, as we've talked about today, broader urban planning in terms of placemaking and the importance of landmarks and interest in routes. So how can transportation planning use this research?
I would like to start just focusing on the method itself.
Yeah.
So a really big advantage of our method is that everything we recorded was geolocated. So we could geolocate our interviews, the photographs, of course, the routes by GPS markers, and in Heike's case, also the air pollution and noise measurements.
You really get a whole gamut of information.
Yes, and you can join it in however you call it, qualitative GIS, just mapping activity, whatever. So it is possible to put all the results in the map. It makes a lot of work, and that's why it's not applied that often, and it's not seen very often, even in research, that people locate interview parts or coded interviews in maps. But it might be really helpful for, like, as a kind of additional information for urban planning. So, of course, if a child mentioned during the interview situation that this crossing is really dangerous, I could map it, and I did. So that's the advantage of the interview itself. And that's why we really would like to recommend to use this tool. There are certain ways how to use it. Of course, you can do it app-based or like web-based in a more open way. But yeah, in general, we would like to highlight that. And maybe Heike, you can add.
Yeah, thank you. Two thoughts. Maybe I think one important aspect would also be to do this walking interviews with a group. So that could be a group walk. So the urban planners can gather some people of a certain district and say, let's walk together through our area and talk about improvements, talk about solutions, talk about your experiences. So you can also use this method in a group, which is a bit more, of course, there's more data than you have because there are more people. Everyone has something to say, but still, I think this would be one possibility. And I actually think it's also done in a lot of planning situations. At least in Berlin, they're doing these group walks sometimes to understand what kind of improvements should be made in the urban quarter. And just an example for Berlin, there was a couple of years ago a possibility for citizens to write down or to map qualitatively where they perceive their environment as noisy. So there was a map from the urban planning page of Berlin. There was a map, and you could just point this area in the city. Here I always hear the sound of the airplanes, or here it is loud because people are walking and sitting in the street and drinking a drink or something like this. And people could put qualitative data into this map. And this everything that was put into the map was then used to develop the noise abatement strategy of Berlin. So I think there are already approaches which make use of this qualitative geolocated data from a map-based approach or with this walking interviews or group walking interviews. So there are positive examples where this is used, but I think there could be a lot of other situations where it could be useful to use these methods as well.
Do either of you have any insight in what maybe has been not accounted for in the planning of our streets and the transportation networks that you're seeing when you're doing these interviews?
Yeah, that of course, also in Europe, the urban areas are mostly planned from the view of cars. So the highest aim is that cars are moving freely, that there's a free floating traffic, and pedestrians have to stay at the side. And that makes it already very difficult, at least for children, which have a low body height, which are kind of hidden in between the cars and not be seen. And they are missing to have an overview. That's something really, really makes it hard. And also that the traffic area is a place to pass. Like, traffic means coming from A to B, and not having a sense of well-being, having like traveling as an activity on its own. Like being active, being physically active, doing kind of sports, being in contact with your environment, being in contact with friends or strangers, whoever, is a focus which is not out there. So there are kind of no benches, for example, to meet others.
It's a no man's land.
Yeah. And like our interviews really show that those places are needed to make those positive experiences and to can connect positive experiences with your own roots and to feel good at your root. Yeah. And that's something which was not covered by urban planning yet. And it's starting. But as I said, for children, at least those are like they build fences around and whatever. So it's not included. Like there are places to stay and places to pass, but it's not connected.
Nothing in between.
And I think it's really important to take this movement seriously of people, that mobility is about movement. And these positive aspects that Juliana said are really important to also embrace them and really take into account what are the aspects that make my movement, my commute or my daily way to school positive. And maybe we should really take a look into these positive aspects and make them and make them really important in our planning decisions. And I just want to point out that in the recent research that was shown that they took a look into the urban planning and compared the aspects of the urban planners with the ones of the cyclists. And it was shown that urban planners do not, or transport planners do not always really know what are the most important aspects for the cyclists. So for example, the cyclists talked about the importance of hidden paths, of side roads, of greenery in the less trafficked roads. Whereas the planners, which is of course true, plant more for the fastest cycling lane, for example, which is important, of course, but they also have to take into account these other aspects which are important for cycling, which make cycling interesting, which makes cycling an interesting and appealing experience. And I think these positive aspects that we can really dive deep into with this mobile interview method are really important to take into account. And then more people might cycle as well, right? The more you make it attractive, the more people are attracted to cycle.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes already very small changes can really improve situations. For example, having cars parking close to the crossing make it really hard for children to overview the crossing and to have a safe crossing. And also the other car user don't see the children because they are behind the parking cars. So it just like forbids 6 car users to park that close to the crossing might improve the situation.
Well, thank you so much for this conversation. I mean it when I say this was so interesting to me to read. I really appreciate your time and all the research you did.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all for now. I really hope you enjoyed. A big thanks to Heike Markart and Juliana Schickatans for joining us on the show today. To read the paper we spoke about and to learn more about their work, see the links in the show notes. You can give us a review to let us know what you think of the show and share it if you know someone who might like to listen. To keep the conversation going and for updates on new episodes, follow us at DenseCityPod on Instagram and Twitter, and subscribe to the show wherever you're listening right now. A special thanks to Emily Huang of Emily H Illustrations for creating the artwork for this podcast. You can see more of her work by following the link in the show notes. Thanks as well to Reed Kai and Ryan Kinnear for the show music. See you next time on Dense City.